Okay. So, is that the board, got the names down?
He's telling us that we're going to have to do this in order to win. You know, we're going to, you know, we have to, in other words, hurt him in the pocket, he said. You know, you can't, these guys won't reason, you know. There's no reasoning with him, you know. That's, you know. And so we have to hurt him economically somehow. You know, we can't do violence, you know. We don't want to do that, burn the sheds and all that stuff. We can't do, never think of that, you know. And so, yeah, he started thinking, you know, that's why I tell the story about that Marcos Munoz. He was illiterate, you know. He didn't know how to read or write. He spoke very little English, just enough to get by, you know. And so he's doing the assignments and all that. And then said, and Marcos, he says, Marcos, we're going to send you to Boston, you know. And he said, where is that? Boston? Never heard of Boston. Where is that? And he said, I just remembered like it was right there. I don't know myself, but I think it's that way. He pointed back east, you know. I'll never forget that, you know. He knew, but he just says, Marcos, I don't even know myself, but I think it's that way. Go look for it. And so then he assigned Marcos, he assigned other people to Detroit, and where the big markets were, you know, we're going to try and do first, you know. These are only primary cities, you know. The best, I think we went to the 5 or 6 primary cities. And there were more primary cities, but we couldn't fill them, you know. That happened later. And then there were secondary cities, what we call. We had it all broken down by cities and where the biggest sales and all that, you know. Oh no, one of the places was Montreal. Montreal or Toronto? Montreal. I think it's Montreal. And New York, Detroit, Philadelphia, Chicago, and some other place. And anyway, Denver, I think, was one of two. And so we assigned people in this. It's okay, so find your way out there, you know. And so we all took off and see, go out, tell people not to eat grapes, you know. That's a, and I look back on it, and my God, what a feat that was. What a challenge, you know. What a thing that made happen, you know. It didn't seem that awesome, that big when it was happening, you know, when we were doing it. But I look back now and what we accomplished, it was really incredible. I mean, it was really an incredible thing that we did, you know, to be able to get people not to buy grapes, you know. Here we're talking about the whole world, you know, because not only did we have to deal with the country, our country, in Canada, but Scandinavia was a big consumer. I think, I forget what percentage, like 15-20% of the grapes went over there, you know. And so we had Europe, too, so it became an international boycott, really, because it was Canada and Scandinavia and this country, you know. But what happened, like I said, I still refer to it as being the 60s, you know. It was a big advantage for some reason, you know. Yeah. You know what was happening, you know. Everybody was trying to save the world. And so we were just happened to be there when everybody was looking for. Well, we were not there in about after a year or so, the boycott took a life of its own, you know. Like, it just took a life of its own, you know. It just, everybody knew about boycotting grapes and the grapes and the farm worker struggle. And not only were we doing, asking people not to buy grapes, but we became very good fundraisers, you know. Ooh, I became an excellent fundraiser. We had to get money to send home to support the guys that were in the picket line, you know. You know what I mean? We wanted to, we have to have a presence. That's all we needed, a nice presence on the fields. But we wanted people to keep on working because that's what we were going to boycott. If they didn't work, we had nothing to boycott. You understand what I mean? They were, in fact, we had some people of our people working inside. Oh, we just did all kinds of good stuff that were. I mean, some very, very intelligent stuff that we did, you know, and a lot of it, Cesar thought about a lot of stuff, you know. We call them submarines, you know. We have our own people working, knowing in there, and we're going to go out there and shout at you and call you scabs and all that, but it's all a show, you know. You keep on working, but talk to the people inside what's happening, you know, give them reports. And it was a mastermind that did this. It was something big, you know. I don't know how to explain what it was. It was unreal, you know. Everything that was happening in combination with the boycott, and we were out there gathering money and stopping, seriously stopping grapes and so forth. And just the boycott in itself could, the book hasn't been written. Very little people have talked about the boycott, and that's what I would like to do, you know, do something on the boycott, because nobody, they just touch on it, but in detail, nobody's really talked about the boycott, you know. And there was a, wow, that in itself is a story. You know? I don't know.
You went out, you were one of the first ones out on the boycott?
Yes.
And where'd you go?
They sent me to New York City.
New York.
Yeah. The first time, because I was in New York 2 times.
Tell me about how you got there and who went with you. And
there was my brother Manuel and myself and Rudy Reyes and Mary Bernier. There were a couple, girlfriend, boyfriend. And Manuel, my brother and I. And actually, Mary and Moses was already, you heard about Mary and Moses, right?
Right.
She was already there, but it wasn't, you know, she was just talking to the union people, like I call it way up above. Nothing was happening, stopping grapes, you know, it was just doing PR stuff, I guess, you know, and whatever little thing. But it wasn't like La Chinga, like doing it day by day and stopping grapes. It wasn't that, you know, it was a lot of PR stuff going on. Well, we went there to stop grapes, and that's when it started happening. And we went and we stayed at the Seafarers. They had their place in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. A really nice place. They gave us half of the hotel. We have some where they, well, people are in training. The Seafarers are in training. Like they're schooling and all that, because this is where the school was. They have this hotel, you know. But half of it was me, so we got that as our living quarters. So it was very nice, and we used to eat at their cafeteria for free. I mean, the best food, and I've never ate that kind of food before, you know. Really good chow, and they bought us 3 new, brand new station wagons, cars, to move the pickets around and go from line to line. Brand new ones. We went to the shop and got them, and they had 3 brand new station wagons to do our work, you know. And so we were very lucky. And everywhere we went, that we were met with that kind of support, you know. Either labor, the church, and the students, or the community organizations, whomever. But labor had played a very big part in the church also. And so we went and we started organizing committees, you know, and forming picket lines and picking front stores and asking to remove the grapes. And we put enough pressure on the store, they would remove the grapes. And then we'd go to another one and, you know, and we had, this is when we started working with, we were forming committees, what they call picket committees in different areas. Like New York has all kinds of barrios, so we would say barrios or areas, and we would go there and form, get somebody and organize somebody to be the coordinator for that area. And you were supposed to, you're in charge of bringing in picket lines on the weekend, you know, and picket Saturday and Sunday and so forth, that sort of thing. We were the organizers. We didn't picket that much. We just set up stuff, come and see that everything was working, and that kind of thing. And it was, and this was happening at the same time in Montreal. It was happening in Toronto and in New York and Philadelphia and Chicago. Some places better than others, you know. In some places you had more support from labor, like New York is a labor city, you know. Labor is very strong. It was very good with labor there. And then also the money started coming in, you know. They would pledge to send so much a month, so it was already going in there. But then we had, in evenings, we had meetings with supporters and fundraisers and wine and cheese, I think they called it, and all that stuff, you know. Anyway, how to raise money. And we raised a lot of money and sent it back home and pay our keep, you know, enough to support ourselves there, and then sent the rest back home too. So it started working very well, you know. Like I mentioned, that the boycott later, 2 years later, it took took a life of its own. I was in New York City the second time. The first time I'm talking in 67, okay? That's when 67, and 68 I came back. And then I worked here or something. And then in 70, they sent me out back to, I went to Detroit this time. And I did all of Detroit and part of Western Ohio, you know, that part area. And I organized, committees all over the state. I mean, I had committees going. I just had to get on the phone and check and all that. But I had, at any given day, I'd have 50, 60 picket lines out there, you know, at different places, in different cities. And And then the second time I went to New York after I got Detroit pretty tied up, you know, says nothing happened in Detroit. There's no hardly any grape going in there. But they're dumping everything in New York, and they sent me. The New York people weren't doing a very good job. They had lost control, and they weren't doing it. So Cesar says, you have to go to New York. So I went to New York, and then we started working. And we were lucky to get it to her. I think that's where it was. One, you know, once you stop New York, you know. They were dumping anywhere in a given week, you know. In a given week, it was from 200 to 400 cars, what they call loads, you know, box cars. That means these box cars. We got it, cut it down to 12 a week. You know, that means we had cinched it. You know, they couldn't even give the grapes away after. You know, yeah. But we had a lot of organization. What happened is that we were in the big cities. Remember, I told you we were in the big cities. Well, some of the colegios, like up at Bennington and all the other, you know, Syracuse and other places, started doing their, everybody heard about, so they were doing their picketing too, you know. Some of those, we didn't even know about them, you know, until they called to New York to get some material that needed buttons and all this. Who are you working? No, we're just picketing, you know. We know that you're picketing the grapes. And so I shoot out there immediately with buttons and all everything that we had to. And that committee was already set by itself, you know. They're picketing stores by themselves, and then they get another. That's what I mean, life of its own. We didn't even have to organize it. They just jumped on the bandwagon, and so it just happened, you know. It just happened. Everybody knew about boycott grapes. And so it's amazing the way it and then we I think about a year before the last season that they went without signing, we knew by the end of the season, I think we knew we had him. We knew that they had really, really hurt him economically that last season, you know. And because people didn't want to hassle, you know. He says, we don't have to carry grapes. We don't get those people out of here, you know, because we don't have to carry grapes. They get them, dump them in front of us, and there. They said, we don't carry grapes anymore. That was clean, and then we go to another chain, because we used to work by chains, you know, like Petmark, you know. We had 100 and some odd stores in the city, and then Waldbaum's had another couple of hundreds, and, you know, we're big, you know. A small chain was somebody had 27, 30 stores. Oh, that was just, you know, we'll just go scare them and they'll take them off, you know. But the world bombs, the big ones, Petmark and all those, they call us AMPs. AMPs and different, you know. And we just cleaned them one by one until they didn't do anything to them. I'm not saying that it just happened like that, you know. We had to do a lot of pressure on them, you know.
Imagine you had a lot of pressure on you too. The counter pressures when you were out trying to organize these boycotts.
Huh? Oh yeah,
get the police.
Oh, see, arresting us and all that. You know, all kinds of stories in between. You know, yeah. I'm just touching on, you know. Yeah. Oh no, we were arrested jillions of times and all that, trying to tell us that we didn't have a right to be there in front of us. And says, no, yes, we do. It's my constitutional right. And so they take us in, and then our lawyer comes in and says, no, they do have the right. And then they argued. And they would do it, but they would arrest us every time, you know. And we just stayed with it, and we're successful. At the end, in New York, you'd go to the, you know what pilon is, right? Pilon? When you go and buy something, and then they give you a little extra because you bought so many. Well, that's pilon. It used to be very common before, you know. Anyway, they were doing pilon thing, you know. They would buy 20 bucks of groceries, something else, 40, whatever, you know. And then they would give 5 pounds of grapes, and people would say, nope, sorry, we don't eat grapes in our house. They would stay right there, you know. They couldn't even give them away, you know. And so, you know, we did it. And then after New York, we were still mopping up, you know, we're still... Sort of, because if they would stop in New York, then Pittsburgh would start selling a lot of grapes, and then that means that people in Pittsburgh couldn't stop them, or they just weren't the story. Then they would send out a special team, you know, to go out there and work out there and tell them what to do. Just, and you know, and it's anyway, there was a mopping up, and I had to go to Scandinavia. I took the European trip and went to England. I was very impressed with labor. Very impressed with the English labor, you know. Very impressed, you know. They don't, like they say, you tell people the drop of a hat to say. Everybody will walk out at the drop of a hat, you know. And they don't ask why are we walking out. You know? They say, we got to walk out, and everybody walks out. And when they're out there, it's just, okay, why are we walking out? And they ask after, you know. I was very impressed. And then I met with the Elmero Chingon, which is, what's his name? Equivalent to George Meany in those days here, you know, the head of the federation. And a lot of big guys. And then we had some good picket lines in England. In London, we had some very good, and in Birmingham, we had some good. And then I went to Oslo. Very good committee in Oslo. We had some very good picket lines there. Well, not so much picket lines. There was a little different. There was pressure from up above. I can't think of the word. The boats would come in, the ship would come in with the boats would come in, the grapes, and they wouldn't unload them. Okay. It was in blockade. Like a blockade, you know. Yeah, it was a blockade, you know.
Yeah.
And first, they would come in and they had some grapes, they would unload everything else except the grapes, you know. And then they would, another boat would come in with grapes and they wouldn't unload anything. They could do it, their labor laws permitted them to do that kind of stuff. We didn't have those laws here, you know. And so the company said, yeah, we can't carry grapes. They're not unloading anything, you know. And so we stopped them there at La Brava. I mean, at La Brava, how can you just stop, you know. But we had some good committees that were working on it. And we had a few picket lines to show you what kind. And it was very strong in Norway, and then we had some very good in Denmark. We had some very good people in Denmark, and then we had some good people in Sweden. Sweden, but we were very strong in Sweden and Norway and Denmark, in England. We had very strong boycott there. You know, that was really great. And I did that tour, I went out there. We had other people over there, you know. We had people that had done the boycott over there. But I went to, you know, just like to representing Caesar, I guess, or the Union or something. And that was a great trip, you know. It was just like I spoke before Parliament in Norway. I went before Parliament to, you know, to tell them our story. And The biggest press conference. They were, you know, the countries are very small over there, so you know, it's not hard to get from one to the other, I guess. The biggest press conference. There was just like press, like God, from all over the part of the world there, you know. And the headlines were just like you would think it was a declaration of war, you know. The eagle that's biggest is that in the corner of the paper, and then Chavez in town or something like that, you know. I mean, like, big stuff, you know. We were big news, you know, because it was so much. And it was just like the biggest press conferences that I had ever seen, you know, in any place. Just must have been at least 100 cameras and I don't know how many newspapers. And we had a press conference, everything. We had a press conference once in Denmark at a luncheon, you know. We had a luncheon. And the press was so patient that they were, as we were eating, they would, you know, they would have to wait to you know, as we were talking, and then they would ask a question, and we would answer, and then keep on eating, and then talking to the people, and it's just something that you'd never see here, you know.
Here in the world, time.
It was like another. Sometimes it's kind of hard to believe that it happened, but it did because I was there, you know.
Yeah.
And it's algo como que, did it really happen? I'm just imagining this. So, that combination of stopping the blockades in Europe, in Scandinavia, and then the picketing, we had sort of like a mini blockade in Canada, but their laws couldn't allow for it. They got in trouble, so but they would do it anyway, you know, and like that sort of thing, cat and mouse they played. But here it was strictly, you know, we had some, I shouldn't say we didn't, longshoremen here in San Francisco. Wouldn't load the grapes. They were just there, you know, they get them in pallets, and then, you know, they're loading everything, and when it's time to load the grapes, you know, everything was loaded except there was a lot of pallets of grapes that were left there, you know, and they couldn't. And then, you know, they complained right away, how come they were loaded? What grapes? We didn't see any grapes, and they just didn't see them, that's why they didn't load them, you know. That sort of thing, you know. And then they would do it again, you know. And, you know, but not like over there. Over there said no unloading of anything, nothing. No unloading of anything. Stop. So how can you argue with something like that, you know? And then, of course, like our picketing here, like I said, then we went from the five major cities to cover all the major cities, you know, which included from Denver up, you know, Denver, I think that what we call the minor cities was St. Paul, Minneapolis, Denver, San Francisco was a minor city, San Jose, Seattle, that size cities, you know.
How did Los Angeles fit into all of this?
So Los Angeles was never a good boycott city, you know, not for grapes, you know. They didn't eat that much grapes in Los Angeles because they grew their own or whatever, you know. It really wasn't a major, you know. We picketed, but we didn't. There wasn't a. No, the big ones were New York and Detroit and Michigan, Boston, in Connecticut, New York, Connecticut, and Montreal, Toronto, Philadelphia, so Pittsburgh, some. And so by the end of the boycott, we had covered all the major cities in a lot of the what we call secondaries. We was Atlanta, Georgia, and you know, Providence, Rhode Island, and you know, Washington, D.C. was in the secondary. So it got to where just everything was covered. You know. And they couldn't sell the grape. We just stopped them. They had a lot of grape in cold storage. They filled the cold storages. They can hold, a lot of grape, you know. They can hold more than half of the crop in there, you know, for a year or so, you know. And they were full. They had no more place to put grapes, and they couldn't sell them at the East Coast. So decided that we had won, you know. That's when John Jamara Sr. called Caesar. Caesar says, you can tell when a people's drinking or drunk, you know. Yeah. But call him at 3 o'clock in the morning. He must have been drinking. Caesar! Yes? Who's this 3 o'clock? Caesar, this is John Jamara Sr. Caesar used to play it out real good. Let's get up and sign a goddamn contract right now. You know. Caesar said, well, I'd be happy to do that, John, but could you wait till about 9 o'clock tomorrow morning? But don't forget, we'll be there. He said, get everybody. I mean, I want you. Are you calling me, so you must be in charge of. Yeah, I can call all these bunch of bastards and get them here. So, okay, have there everybody at 9 o'clock. Line them up. You're going to sign contracts. And sure enough, next morning, they were all there at 9 o'clock, like little lamb going to the slaughterhouse. You know. What a scene that was. I could just. I had.
How did it feel?
It's like you couldn't believe it. You know, it's just like it was. What a moment! After all that we went through, it was 58 months later. You know, 58 months later, we got it. We got the contracts.
I'm real curious about that, the meeting. The first night when Professor says, we're going to have a boycott, you're going to go here. Mm-hmm. You had a list of five or six cities on the board. How were people responding? Are you saying, okay, I'll go to Chicago?
Everybody wanted to go someplace. Else. Oh, yeah, no, they were, these volunteers were just, they just wanted to go right now, you know.
And you sent off about
five or six people to each city, one carload, or?
No, it wasn't. No, it wasn't that many. In Marcos, we sent. Marcos, we just sent two people to Boston. Let me tell you, you know, that's the way it was.
You remember who the other boycott leaders were? I know Eliseo went to Chicago, right?
Eliseo, Maria Magana, she's here. She's one of them that went to Chicago. I went remember I came later. Mary and Moses went to New York. Marcos went to Boston. I think Marshall Gantz and other people went to Toronto or Montreal, one of the two. And then, you know, and Frank Ortiz went to Pittsburgh, and somebody else went to Michigan. Rangel, Eugenio Rangel went to Detroit. Went to Detroit, and you know, it's like I said, it's long time ago. I can't remember the names, but we all got. We all got our places, and the people were volunteered to go.
When Cesar brought up at the meeting, I've got this hot idea. We're gonna have boycott. People at the meeting think he was crazy.
Not at the meeting. Our friends in labor and other parts.
This was the first. Well, there's probably been some talk about it around, right?
Mm-hmm.
Headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
We had the meeting, and everybody pretty much thought it was going to be a great.
Oh
idea.
Yes, yeah. That's Boycotta. That night was born. Boycott the hell out of them.
Uh-huh.
Let's boycott the hell out of them.
How soon did they leave?
Within 3 or 4 days.
Three or four days.
The first people started leaving. And, yeah.
And some of the people left for cities where they didn't really have any contacts.
Nothing. Just maybe a union, you know. Just maybe a union contact. Somebody in a union over there. You know.
Mm-hmm.
There was a very sympathetic guy would set him up or something. Would help him with whatever. Others had a priest. They were very nice. Father Joe is a very nice guy. You go talk to him. Mm-hmm. As for Father Joe, he died 3 years ago. I'm sorry, you know. Then so you want to cry. You could, like, the middle of New York City, the only contact I had. You know. And Father Joe died 3 years ago. What am I going to do? You know, just like feel like crying. But if you're an organizer, yeah, you know. You're an organizer, you'll find a way about how to survive, you know.
One thing else that we skipped was your creating the flag and how that happened.
Oh, didn't we talk about that last time?
No, we talked about it the other day at that meeting.
Oh, at the meeting, okay.
Yeah, that's how I was.
Oh, okay, let's go back. We have to go back to 1962 then. Mm-hmm. Okay, I thought we had talked about it on tape, but we didn't. Is it fair to go back?
Sure. You can go back and tell us about swimming in the canal at Yuma if you remember something else, you know.
See,
that's
okay.
Fine.
This is 62. I mean, remember I told you that Cesar had come in from Oxnard after he had won that little battle over there, and he felt like, hey, this can be done. Si se puede, I guess, you know. And I was living in the lane already, you know, so he came and he rented a house, and I was very happy then because he had never been apart that long, you know, really like living right next door to each other together, you know, or at least in the same town, you know. We had always pretty much together. This is the only time that we kind of went his way and I went my way, and we were trying to make it, you know. And he came, so I was very happy, and then we were all very happy that Cesar was in town. You know, he told me he was going to be working, but he needed a place to work out of it, and a phone. That's all he said. I just need a phone where I can get calls and make calls. He says, okay, so I have a phone, you know, so that's taken care of. And my wife, you know, volunteered to get names and numbers, you know, so we could call people back. Anyway, then that was, we started, we were going to have, Cesar had already organized committees, you know, because that's what he was doing. Like in CSO, you know, you organize a chapter, but this were committees, you know. Like he had committees in Corcoran, Julio Hernandez, some of the first, you know, in Corcoran, and then he had Gilbert Lopez in that group in Hanford, and then he had people in Parlier, people in Exeter, people in the Farmersville, and on and on. We had people that were the committee, they were the people up front. Need anything, pick up the phone, says, you know, we want, can you bring 10 people from, or whatever, you know, from, yeah, we're going to have a meeting. Sure, man, it happened. You know. We had already had those committees set up. We were just organizing. We weren't ready for the strike. It happened prematurely, but that's what he was doing. He wanted to get more committees throughout the state to you know, but he had quite a few, but he thought he needed more time. Anyway, I lost my...
The
flag. So we already had an organization as far as that, you know, it was the Farm Workers Association. It wasn't national. We found that out the other day. It was Farm Workers Association. And we were already doing some things, you know. We were already helping people with providing services. That's how they used to organize. We provided services for people to, you know. And you give people something, you know, it's better than just promising, you know. So we already providing services and stuff like in Delano. He had I don't know where in the hell he found batteries in Los Angeles for $9. He would sell them brand new batteries to the people for $9. You know where he found them? I don't know. Probably somebody was sympathetic or just I have no idea. Up to this day, I don't know where he found those batteries. But he would have new batteries for $9. You know, that was a great deal. You know, $9 or $7. I don't know. And then he got oil for 9 cents a quart, you know, or 10 cents a quart. You know, most farm workers have those oil cans, you know.
Yeah.
You just gotta put, fill it with oil and check the gas or something that, you know. So anyway, you know, people love that kind of stuff, you know, because you know, and you, not only did he do some income tax and go argue with welfare or whatever. But you could also get batteries and oil, and I think you had tires at one time. You know, anything to service the people to get them. You know, says you have to do that to organize people. So that was going very well. And so by this time we already felt we had a little organization going. And says, you know what, guys? We're an organization now. Says we need a logo or so. We don't have nothing. No people. You know, we gotta, when they see it, they know it's us. You know. Yeah, great idea. He said, yeah, we should come up with something. He says, okay, Richard, I'm commissioning you to do this because you're the artist in the family. Just come up with something, you know. Give me an idea. What are you thinking of? Well, I don't know. Some represents power, like an eagle or so, you know, like the eagles always represent power or something like that, you know. It's okay, fast, easy. That's easy. So I copied the Mexican eagle, you know, instead of a nopal, I put it on top of a grapes, you know, grape, and took the serpent, whatever, beak, you know, and kind of real strong looking eagle kind of look. And I was very proud of my drawing, and it took me a long time to do it, but I did. And I presented it. Oh, gee, that's nice. And everybody liked it, but he said, Richard, that's very nice, but I was thinking, can we come up with something that almost anybody can duplicate? You know, it's easy to duplicate, you know. This is nice, but who in the hell can draw that eagle all the time, you know? Well, me fui muy desconsolado, kind of, you know. So, man, I started thinking, what is he, how can I come up with something that represents him? I started thinking, you know. Thunderbird came into my mind, something with straight lines and squares. Anybody can do that, you know. I said, you know, almost anybody can draw a line in the square and steps and all that. And he said, oh, and started jotting some stuff down. He says, and I got it, you know. And then I had the head above the wings, you know, and I didn't like it, so I just kind of put it down and made the wings level with the head. You know, all those little things, you know. And then on at the bottom, when I started, I didn't know how to finish it down at the bottom, you know. I put some feet, you know. Well, the eagles have feet, you know, so I put a couple of feet, you know. But it didn't look good, looked out of place, you know. And then I brought it to says, started like chicken feet and all that, you know, started making fun of it. It didn't look good, you know. So, back to the drawing board. Obviously, they didn't, it's not going to get it, you know. And then I tried a fantail, but it didn't look good because the other, everything else is square, and I couldn't make a fantail square. Anyway, and so it looks too much like a fan, you know. And so I just kind of, I went back, you know, third time. And one night I was thinking out very hard, you know, obviously, I guess, you know, it's when you, the time that you're in between awake and asleep and all that, and I thought of the, I saw the eagle and I saw that bar in the bottom, like, you know, see, that little bar in the bottom, you know, I didn't have that, I just had the feet and fantail and all that, you know, it didn't look good. So I came to me and I just thought of it and then just got up right away, and I didn't let it, I got up and I got my little drawing and put that bar in the bottom. Yeah, that looks good to me, you know. I liked it, you know. And so, yeah, next time that I presented it to the board, and says, this is what I came up with. Wow, that's it! Like everybody at the same time. That's it, that's it, that's it. And that was approved right there and there, you know. And I had my oldest son, the one that got killed in the auto accident. He would help me. He would draw pretty good, you know. He was very good. He could draw, you know. And then I said, do this and do this. And he would do it for me. He would do the work, actually. And finally, he came up with it. He says, yeah, that looks good, Dad. I like that. That's how it came about, you know.
And that was a pencil sketch at that time, though, right?
See, yeah.
And how did you get to the colors?
Oh, the colors. See, he told me that before. He says, you do the design. I says, what color do you want? He says, you do the design, and I'll come up with the colors, you know. He already had in mind his colors, I'm sure, you know. And sure enough, when he, you know, black eagle with a white thing with a red flag, and you know what it looked like. God, you know, you look at it, you know, and all of a sudden it looked like the swastika, you know. I'm not like, but, you know, like, yeah. Those are the colors. Mm-hmm. And I said, eagle, Caesar, we're going to, this is really striking, but is this, we're going to have a test? No, why should we? But, you know, it looks like this. You know the reason, Richard, is because it's the most powerful combination of colors you can put together. That's the most powerful combination. That's why people use it. And we're going to use it. We're not a swastika. We're an eagle. It's just a thunderbird. Way different than that. You know? And yeah, sure enough, people accepted it. You know, they got used to it. And we unveiled it in 1962, where it says there, you know. And that's when my brother Manuel was... nobody had. Cesar chose the colors because of striking, you know, to just make an impact, you know. But Manuel got emotional when he unveiled the, you know, we drew it más grande, you know, on paper, you know, butcher paper, but bigger size, you know. And when he unveiled it, and then it very dramatic unveiling it, you know, we want everybody to see it for the first time. And it was already in colors, you know. And then Manuel took it upon himself to he was up there and was pumped up and he wanted to start describing the colors, what they meant, you know. The the black was for all the suffering and misery that we have gone through and the suffering of the farm workers, which was, it jived, you know. And the white is for the pureness of our movement and the hope and things like us and everything, you know. And he came to the red and he got kind of choked. He didn't. And the red is for... the red is for all the blood's going to be spilled for this movement. And I used to make fun. Everybody used to make fun of him later, you know. He wasn't prepared to describe the colors. He didn't. He, the red and the white were kind of, it flowed pretty good. It came out. But the red, he got stuck, and he said, it's for the blood that's going to be spilled. You know? So it was kind of funny. So that's a story on that, and that was adopted as the official
symbol,
and it's registered. It's a registered trademark, you know.
Yeah, that's what 40 years now, huh?
Yeah, 40 years.
Yeah, 40 years.
40 years.
40 years, almost. You got, that was September, that first meeting, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
I want to talk about one of the things you were talking about, the boycott, those 58 months. Wanna go to La Paz?
Yeah, I think we'd better. We wanna get some to eat. And that's like, I can make some here, but let's go over there. I think it's, yeah.
I wanted to ask you to basically retell the story of the 40 acres. That was during the time of the boycott, right?
Yeah, it was a little before the boycott. A
little before the boycott. So actually before you started the boycott, you...
We were in the salon where we're making assignments. The salon is already there, you know.
Okay.
So the 40 acres actually happened in... Oh, I've been 63.
No, 67 maybe, after the grape strike, huh?
When we acquired the 40 acres?
Yeah.
No, when we bought them, it was before then.
We bought it before the strike?
Oh, yes.
Oh, you got it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how did it come about? Yeah, okay.
Let me think about it. Yeah, I think we had it, yeah. We didn't build it until later. That's what it was. We had the property, but we weren't using it as a 40 acres yet. Then, you know.
Yeah.
Then until we built on it later.
So it was 40 acres terreno baldio when you got it?
That's probably what it was.
Yeah.
I think the first thing we did was dig a well.
Dig a well, right.
Put a pump in there and that's it. But we had no buildings until later.
So how did you get it? How did it come about? How did you find it?
Remember it was...
Right. I want this on tape though.
Well, yeah. It wasn't on tape on.
No, we was at lunchtime.
Oh, it was...
Yeah, there's a couple stories you told us at lunchtime. I'm going to ask you to repeat now.
Nice.
So
yes.
Now this is your chance to improve them.
No, the thing came because I was saying how bad of a businessman Cesar would have been. You know,
yeah.
Very good organizer, but not too good on business.
Yeah.
We were renting a little place... In fact, our new project, you know, it's the senior citizens project housing there in Delano. I don't know if you've seen it yet or not, you know. It's right across the street where we had a little office. It was just old vineyards, and there would be the last thing in. I would have never even come close to dreaming that we would have housing for people there in the future, you know. There were just some vineyards. There was some grower that had vineyards there, you know. We were just at that little, right in the esquina of First and I think it's First in Albany. A little place, a little, just, maybe 300-400 square feet little building.
Yeah.
And we used that as an office. That was the first office. And so we were thinking that at some point we had to get some land to have our own office for the future, you know.
Yeah.
We were thinking, but we had no money in that. And we had talked about, you know, buying a lot somewhere. So never dreamed of acres, it was just a lot, you know. Leroy Chatfield, who was running the service center at that time, had this friend that knew this lady in Pasadena. I don't even know if they were relatives or what, but anyway, he knew this lady that had some land. I told her she had some land in Delano and that she wanted to get rid of it, you know. Because Leroy was saying that we're looking for a small piece of land or a lot or something. She says, but I don't know if you guys would be interested since it's 40 acres. She tells me, I don't even know where it's at. She doesn't even know where it's at. She just knows that it's west of Delano, about 3 or 4 miles in Tarsus or something. And she said, and she's old now, and she wants to get rid of it. She's never seen the land. She's never been here. She doesn't want nothing to do with it. She just wants to, you know, get rid of it. And Leo says, it's right next to the dump, you know. There's the dump there, you know. She says, there's a fence, and then the land on this side, you know. And then he described where it was, so Leroy and I went out and looked at it. It was just
The desert, you know, just like sagebrush and, you know, all uneven there, just washes it. And so he says, how much she want for this? She said she was asking about $3,000. She said, you find for sure? She said, I'll talk to her. I have her number, so she... And she said, yeah, she would take $3,000 too. And he totally wrote it, said, yeah, she'll take the $3,000. She said she just wants to get rid of it. And that's when Leroy came to me and said, look, Richard, there's this place of landscape. You want to go look? Just take a ride over there. We're not there yet. Yeah, so, you know, we found it where she was. Hey, Ray. Okay. And we went and looked at it. And it was just like, well, you know, just sagebrush. You know, just starting to boondocks out there. But it's 40 acres. Here and all that, and started making plans and all. And she only wants $3,000. God, is that a good price? That's a giveaway. She's giving it away, you know. And we're all excited. So let's go see Caesar and tell him about this good news. So we went to Caesar, you know. And Caesar, we got great news for you. And so, look, this is, he told all about the lady and she wanted to read it. And where is it? It's
You talked to Cesar.
Yeah, we thought it was a great deal, which we knew it was a great deal. You know, like $1,000 for 40 acres, you know, it was just raw land, you know. It's just like, you know, that's how much they were selling an acre for or something like that, you know, or close to it, you know. So anyway, we knew it was a great deal, and we just thought, this is our chance. And this is, and we went to talk to Cesar, and says, Cesar, this great deal, guy, 40 acres, and she's only $3,000. Well, you go back to her and negotiate, see if you can bring it down to 2,000 or 2,500 or something like that. Just do some negotiations. Yeah. And Leroy looked at each other and says, oh my God, this guy is crazy, you know. You know, it was already, we knew.
Yeah.
They're giving it away, you know. And so we went back and said, no, we're selling it. I'm not either. We're just, we think we're crazy. And then we go with some stupid like that, you know. And I said, Leroy, let's buy it, you know. Because he was running the service center, which is not, it's not the union, it's the service center. It's not part of the union. But Caesar had a lot to say. He was one and the same for him, you know.
Yeah.
And so he said, Richard, you'll kill us. I don't care, Leroy, I'll go first. Then you can follow me. And he was just joking, you know.
Yeah.
He says, no, I don't think we better do it. No, Leroy, I think we better, because somebody else is going to get that land and we're going to kick ourselves in the butt, you know.
Yeah.
Caesar will get very mad, you know. And he says, okay, he's your brother. He can just yell at you and all this, but I'm going to feel pretty bad if he does that to me, you know, and all that. And, oh, no, Leroy, come on, it's worth it. Don't you think it's worth it? Yeah, it's worth it. But I mean, so we kind of propped each other up. Let's do it. So we kind of verbally made a deal, yes. You know, yes, we wanted, you know. When can we write papers and all that? And we had set a deal. And the guy says, well, I'll find you through escrow and all that. And so we didn't say anything. Cesar found out that we had done it, you know. And we thought he was going to get real. Like, he wasn't, you know, it's kind of, it's okay. You know, it's a good deal. And found out that it was good. And so. We go out there and just look at the property every now and then, just to see if it was still there, you know. In those days, there was still a dump there in the lane, you know, so they used to dump there, you know.
Yeah.
And they used to burn there and all that, but in time, all that moved out and there's nothing there, right? And so, we all felt good about that. We had land now, and everybody was proud of it.
Yeah.
We made the right decision, and we were kind of heroes at it for once. You know? It was everything was good, you know? And then he says, "Well, he says, we have to start clearing it up, you know." We can make work. We had, like I said, we had no money. We had nothing. Nobody got paid. Yeah. Nobody had money to go anywhere. Not even to the movies or nothing. We just had nothing, no. And so he says, we can spend it, like on Sundays, we can make work crews and you know, take a day off from organizing, come and do this kind of work. And so we all each other encourage each other. So we start cleaning, and we'd go out there and clean, clear brush and all that, you know. And then there was a friendly farmer in Pixley over there. You know, there was some around, you know, this one of them, you know. And somebody asked him, the guys asked him, they were talking to him, said, did he know anybody that would rent, not cheap, you know, could rent some equipment so we could, and he came and looked at it. Oh, I said, yeah, you can do that with a box scrape. You see, you don't need one of those carry-alls, you know, you got a lot of time. That's all we have, just that. Oh, it's okay, so I got a big tractor, and I'll let you guys use it, you know. All you have to do is buy the diesel for it, of course. Yeah. And you get the big old thing with a big box scrape, you know, I mean big. And so I started leveling off, you know, just the big places, cutting them, filling in the little places. Yeah. And what am I now to do? I spend my Sundays over there, you know. Go out there and work all Sundays since early morning, driving the tractor till like, ya no miraba, you know. Yeah. I was into it, you know.
Yeah.
And it started looking better every time. And the brush was gone. We had burned all the chamizo, sage, and all the tumbleweeds, and everything was clear. You know, it was still up and down, and a lot of. And so I started to look at bringing dirt from the high place to the low place, and it took me a while. And we was paying 9 cents a gallon for diesel in those days. 9 cents.
Yeah.
Because it was for farm diesel.
Diesel, no road tax. Yeah.
So 9 cents a gallon. So we. Those 55 gallons, we had two or three or four out there, and I put together. And I'd spend my time with her. Anyway, got it to work. Start to look decent, pretty nice, you know, like, you know, it's looking better every day, you know. Filled in all the low spots and everything.
Yeah.
And where I got it to where it was, you know, it looked pretty decent. You know. I cut all the big spots and filled in, and it was just like a big, nice field, you know, it was just. Yeah. Flat, you know? Okay, he says, we're going to need some water here so we can get some trees going, right?
Yeah.
Something that we can build right away. Trees ought to get started, you know. And so, well, we're going to need a pump for that, you know. He says, find out how much we can get a pump for. So I started negotiating with Whitney Pump and the Lena, you know, pumps and all that, you know. And so we did. And he went out there and tested first. Yeah, I says, I think, it's not too deep here. You know, we don't have to go that deep, you know?
Yeah,
put that scatter stuff.
Yeah, okay.
Anyway, there's water here pretty close. What size pump are you? Well, you know, I think at least a 3-inch or 2-inch. You get one irrigates? No, you gotta go at least 4s. And I advise you to put in a big casing. You know? And then at any time you can put in a big pump. You know? If the casing is big, then you're safe. You know?
Yeah.
Then you can bring in a 4, a 6, or an 8, whatever you want.
Whatever you want, yeah.
Any pump or whatever you want. So let me recommend, put in a big casing, put in a 10. So it's going to be a little more money right now, but it's well worth it, you know.
Yeah.
Talked us into it and told us why and all that. And so we went with that, you know. And then we put a 4-inch, we had 4 inches of water just like that, you know.
Yeah.
And so we started planting trees and irrigating, whatever, you know.
Yeah.
It was, and then now where do we want it to, you know? So, there's 40 acres. Where do you put the pump?
Where do you put the pump, yeah.
And so I guess after all, we thought a lot about it, so I think we put it in the right place. It was right out towards the middle of the place. And I was like, why did you put it in the middle? Why didn't you put it once in a... No, because we're going to build here. And we already had in our mind what it was going to be. And it looks like it's the right place because everything has been growing around it.
Yeah.
So anyway, it was a lot of fun. That was a fun period because we had something we could call our own, and then now we have the pump, you know, and we have water now, and things started coming afterwards. You know, I think the first building we built was at I don't even know where it was, the service station. I had no idea. Remember I told you in Cesar, we very very beginning he was selling batteries and oil.
Yeah.
Where later, when the strike started, we rented an old and a gas station, because of the strike, it was just hundreds of cars, and we So we rented our own because they had the big tanks, and then people would go there and gas up in the morning and that kind of thing. Yeah. We needed to. It wasn't for the public, it was just for us, but it was right in town, so it was our own private gasoline, you know. And I guess we thought that we needed a gasoline station the first thing. Up to this day, I really don't, can't tell you why. But yeah, we had our mechanic shop and everything, you know. And so that's what we did. The first thing we did in the 4 acres, we were going to need the service station so we can give this up. And so we ended that beautiful building. We've been to the 4 acres. It's a beautiful building. As you go in, it's all adobe.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's real adobe.
Yeah.
And I built that one, and it was a service station, like 4 pumps, and then we had a mechanic shop right next to it, because I thought we were going to be in strike all our life. I don't know why. Up to this day, I don't know why, but that's the first thing. That,
yeah.
I've often wondered why the service station was the first thing.
I don't know. I don't. To be honest, yeah, I can't remember.
That's a good answer.
There must have been a good reason, you know, because we were paying over there, so we don't. So
you stopped paying rent over there.
Yeah, paying rent. And I guess that was the reason. Anyway, I got to build it, so it's good for me. Yeah. It's good enough for me. And so that was our very first building. And then we started planting some trees and stuff like that, you know, around. And then the 40 acres, you see, there's like a little park there,
mm-hmm.
the park and all this.
Yeah.
That land, as you know, I told you, I was leveling it off and all that, you know, was highly alkaline, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, just. You would put water in you, the salt would form that thick on top of it. Just alkaline.
Yeah.
And there's nothing is going to grow here and all that. Then I designated, after we built the service station, I designated that area back out, you know, up to where the new building built. The salon is right
there.
Yeah. And I said, I'm going to plant some trees here. And I put the word out in the Bay Area that I needed some palm trees, you know, for the 40 acres. Well, anything for the 40 acres. And then people would, before Berkeley sent a truckload of palms, you know, I mean, those panita chiquita palms.
Yeah.
And they're the ones that are there, you know.
Yeah.
As you go into the drive, they're just lined up with palms.
Yeah.
I planted those. We put out the word, and before we knew it, here comes a semi-truck full of palm trees to the 40 acres. And that was a nice project. We all, you know, dug the holes, and you dig here and dig here, and we'll plant them, and we made everything a project, you know, to keep the, it was a good organizing thing to keep the community going. Mm-hmm. Some community by then, you know, to keep them, we had no money to do anything else, so we worked together, and it was like recreation, in fact.
Yeah.
And we planted this, and so we had water, so we put the water, and we could water them and everything. And then time passed, and I'm going to build a park right here. I said, oh, you're crazy. She said, nothing will grow there. He said, she looked at it. Okay, I'm going to grow this. So I started in the Friday night meeting. I would ask for volunteers for Sunday morning. Okay. I said, I'm going to need as many, but at least 10 or 12 people for Sunday for the 40 acres. Hands started going up. Okay, we'll meet you over there at 7. And then we go in and say stuff. Because they bought us a lot of trees also in there. And 5 gallon buckets or whatever. And we'd go out there and make a hole about the round of the table, more or less, you know. And then about 5 feet deep. Take all the dirt out of there and go to the creek and bring some sand and some good soil from other places, you know, from fertile soil from other places. And then we'd throw in leaves and grass and mulch, whatever, you know, just and then plant the tree. Every tree like that is planted like that, the 40 trees. And when they said it wouldn't grow, then we started watering, the tree started to grow, you know, because now there's no alkaline because we planted grass and it's been watered for years and years and years. We have all leached all that stuff down.
Yeah.
But at first, that's what we had to do to plant the tree there. And so we spent a lot of time, and then we'd fertilize the place, and somebody would bring us a load of gypsum, you know, truckload and dumped it there, and then we'd all get an old cart, we hit there and pull it with a new tractor and gypsum all over the place. That was our project. The 40 acres was our jewel. It was our where we spent our time, you know.
Yeah.
And that was recreation for everybody, you know, strikers, whatever, volunteers. And so we spent a lot of time doing things by hand, you know, so and then we'd have somebody would make lunch, and we'd eat there together, and with some soda, maybe sometimes we were lucky, somebody would bring beer at the end of the day, and, you know, so that's good. we had a lot of fun doing that, and it wasn't until now this is I'm thinking, because we started that building, the what is the salon right now, mm-hmm. the administration building, and it's one of those when I came back from New York, I think is the first time, you know, remember I told you I was in 67?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I came back in 68, and I think it's when I started the building. We did the floor and everything, and we even put some of the fierro, the herramienta, you know, and it stayed there. I think we put a roof on it too. You know?
Yeah.
And, but we never finished it. It stayed there for, then the boy got started getting hot, and they sent me to Michigan, and this building just stayed there. I went and did all that boycott all those years, you know, a couple of years, the one in Michigan, one in New York. And when I came back, I picked up where I had left and finished that building. But sat there for a couple of years, just for the size and the roof on it. And by that time, it's when they called me back. We were pretty sure we were going to be getting contracts pretty soon, so we had to finish the building. So that building was very new when we got the country. It was very new. And that's where they came and signed. But that's how we acquired that place and what happened there. And then later, came the clinic in the Agbayani village boat. By that time, we were, even though we hadn't gotten the contracts yet, we were raising a lot of funds, we were raising a lot of money, you know, people were sending in for, and then we started thinking, we have to have a clinic for our people, you know.
Yeah.
No, because we did have a clinic, and I'll take that back. We did have a clinic, but not the one that we talked about. We had a clinic at different, in town, you know. We'd rent a house and make it a clinic, you know. There were some nurses there, and doctors would come in on weekends and treat people, and that sort of thing, you know. We had to go. So we did have a clinic already, but it wasn't the one. And this is, but we got to have a clinic here at the 40 acres. And then we'd get together and meet on a Sunday and then discuss about the clinic and how we're going to do and all this, you know. And that kept going. And that was like a pastime by that time. Yeah. It was Caesar's pastime, really, you know. He used to get everybody together and just talk. And I was sick. I was sick, you know. I was getting sick of those meetings and nothing happening, you know, as far as... And one day I walked out of a meeting, I blew up, you know. You guys are not goddamn serious about a clinic. You know, when you get ready to do a clinic, you goddamn, you call me. Now don't bother me for goddamn meetings no more. And I just stomped out. And I was mad. I got out and went the hell out there and get drunk or something. That was in the Sunday. And he wasn't there Monday, so Tuesday morning came. Because, you know, he used to get to an argument. So we make up right away. We never stayed mad, you know. We just kind of, either one or the other would find a way how to, you know, make up right away. And so he says, he came to us. He says, are you busy? Not really. He says, you know, there's some stuff. Come, let's take a walk. So we used to take a walk. Took a walk. He says, you really think we can build a clinic here and all that? Of course we can. I've been telling you guys, but you guys aren't serious about a clinic. He says, well, why don't you get started? That's all he said. Because we had two old buildings that was the welfare buildings, and they were good sound buildings, yeah. You know. That they gave them away, and so we got them. You know, we heard that they were giving away, so we would have to cut them in half to move them.
Because yeah.
They were too long. It's like a barrack type thing.
Yeah.
And we had those two things on blocks that said just sitting there. That was going to be part of the clinic. And he says, you think we can make a nice clinic? Says, of course we can. Says, well, okay, why don't you see if we can get started? That's all I needed to know, man.
Yeah.
Next day, I was already had guys digging dishes for the foundations and all that. What's happening here? Says, I'm building a clinic.
Yeah.
That's great. Okay. So that was it, you know. I right away laid out where they were going to go and, you know, foundations and stuff, and started to run some water, and you know, you need pipelines. But you know, what you have to do.
Yeah.
To do. And sure enough, in a few months we had a clinic. You know, because we already had those buildings. I just remodeled them and made a new. I didn't put them together like they were. I opened them up, and in between, I built a brand new
waiting room and all of that, reception, the reception room, and the sides were cleaning, and that turned out very nice and fun, still there, you know. And sure enough, we had on clinic, you know, for years and years and years. And then we got our own doctors. Yeah, they weren't people that came on weekends.
Yeah.
This was our own doctor. We started hiring our own, and the nurses and everything. In fact, that sometimes they were delivering babies there and everything, you know, like that kind of a clinic, you know. And it served its purpose for many years, you know. And later, then we had more clinics. You know, we had a clinic in Salina, we had a clinic in Coachella, we had a clinic in Fresno, and so we had five or six different clinics, and I was running all that stuff. I was in charge of service center by that time, you know, and I was doing all this, plus the other work that had to be done. And I was from, yeah. And one by one, we started shutting them down, you know, and found out that... we couldn't afford to run the way we were running, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it was almost a nothing fee to go there, you know. People didn't even pay that nothing fee, you know. You had to. In other words, we couldn't. We found out that we couldn't. We couldn't pay for the whole. Thing, you know. We could pay for part of it, but not the whole thing. We couldn't subsidize.
Yeah, then they weren't self-sufficient. So.
No, they weren't self-sufficient. We couldn't subsidize forever. So
yeah.
We said, look, you know, I think you already come a long ways. They've done what they were supposed to do. We helped a lot of people. People have contracts now. They can afford to have a medical plan. You know?
Yeah.
So everything we made up our mind was it's closing. Mm-hmm. So we started closing one by one by one. So finally, we closed them down. And that one was, the one in Delano was named after Rodrigo Terrones, one of the first, he was one of the founders of the union.
Mm-hmm.
He was the first vice president. He died in a freak accident right there in the 40 acres. You know. And so we named that clinic after him. So it was called Rodrigo Terrones Memorial Clinic. And the building's still there now. They're using it as an administration. They moved out of the clinic. After we closed the clinic, somebody else rented it, and some other group opened the clinic up. They ran for a few years, and then another group. And, you know, finally, we said, you know, we moved everything from the main building to and made those offices instead of clinic. We remodeled and made offices out, and it was a very nice office. And that was it. And then the Agbayani village, our retirement village, that also came about because of need. Everything's some need, you know. The you probably heard the story of the Manongs, of old Filipinos.
Yeah.
They came to this country. They didn't bring their women with them. They grew old, and none of them had families. And, you know, very sad story, really. You know. And they were getting old. But they had no family. They had nobody. So we thought that somebody had to do it. Somebody had to be responsible, you know? And since we were part and they were part of our movement, our union, we would build their retirement so they could spend the last years of their lives, Augusto, you know, in a peaceful place, you know. Then we did, and it worked very well. Also, we did. It worked. It served its purpose until the last one was gone. You know, they lived there. Each one had their private room, you know. They had their community kitchen. So we had a cook that cooked for them and cooked their food. And, you know, they worked very well, you know, for many years. And they started dying off one by one by one. Until there was no need, it served its purpose also.
Yeah.
And so it's there, you know. These are things that are passing.
Yeah.
And then the administration building, which is the big salon, that was built as a, this was the office complex first, but it also had a big hall for the meetings. Instead of the Filipino hall, then we moved everything to the 40 acres, and that was our meeting hall. For many years, we used it like that for the meetings and all that. And I think it's still used once in a while for that, you know.
Yeah.
But the main purpose of that salon is rented every weekend, Saturdays and Sundays, and sometimes during the week. You know, that's the salon in Delano where people want to go. There's others. There's a VFW and there's American Legion.
Yeah.
But people want to go there.
Yeah.
it's out, you know, it's, yeah. It's more private, yeah. So there's a park right there, they can combine the salon with a park. And,
yeah.
So it has worked, everything has worked well, yeah. You know, yeah. But we intended to do it, it did, you know, some yeah. have already served this purpose and beyond that, and others still serving the purpose.
Yeah.
So that's, in a nutshell, that's the story of the 40 acres.
40 acres. Now, but at some point, you basically move the core of the operation out of there, though, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that was when we came to La Paz.
When you came to La Paz. Okay, now once again, we know we talked over lunch about how you got La Paz. So
La Paz, the use of the 40 acres was no longer to our advantage.
Okay.
Let me tell you what happened.
Okay.
When we were starting, I'll tell you about the FWA.
That's going to take some redoing because everybody says yeah. NFWA, right?
Well, later.
Yeah.
Even FWA. We were small, it was like a small family, and everybody talked directly to Caesar. You know, he was the one that could solve their problems. Nothing just to anything, and he says, okay, we'll see, we'll see, whatever, you know, but it kind of, Caesar was a godfather, if they didn't talk to him, it was like, you know, something missing, right? But it came that time where we started growing, and started getting contracts and all that, and Caesar didn't have that time, you know?
Yeah.
Caesar had a lot more work to do than to be sitting there, even if it was 5 minutes talking to somebody, he didn't have those 5 minutes anymore, you know? He just didn't, you know?
He
got to a point where they were kind of choking him, you know,
mm-hmm.
because he wasn't rude. He couldn't say, no, I can't see you, or go to somebody else, you know, say I'm busy. He would still pay attention to them and the same courtesy and everything, but he was being choked, you know. So he said, guys, I said, you could see what was happening. He said, you know, I have to move out of here. He says, I can't be here.
Yeah.
You know, people mean well.
It wasn't functioning anymore.
It wasn't functioning.
Yeah.
They don't let me do my work anymore.
Yeah.
It's like, I can't do that. Yeah. I don't have that luxury of talking to people, you know, like.
Yeah.
Some just want to come in and talk, you know, about the weather or whatever, you know. And he says, and I hate to be rude, but I have to move. He says, I have to get out of here so I can do my work, you know. So we started looking for a place in Fresno. Well, no, it still says it in Fresno would be the same thing. They're just going to go that way, you know. And again, it looked like they really found all our property. This, I don't know if the same guy himself, but somebody working told Leroy about this place here. And he said, well, Caesar, there's that place. I know, but it's out of the way. The plan, where is it? It's up in the mountains, up to going towards Tehachapi. And how far is it? You have no idea where King was. Well, it's about 28 miles, 30 miles east of Bakersfield, so up going towards Tehachapi. And it's at the mountains here. But that doesn't sound too bad. It's not that far from Delano.
Yeah.
It's only an hour from Delano.
Yeah.
20 minutes from, 30 minutes from Bakersfield. And, you know, it's this. That's not bad, we should look at that place. That's where we found out that they wouldn't show it to us, you know, off limits. And then the other story I told you, that how we, they wouldn't show it to us, and so we couldn't just come like anybody else could, right? So we wanna bid it.
Yeah, this is excess county property, right? They're going to
get rid of it because they don't need it anymore. This should be a TB sanitarium.
Right.
In fact, my first wife was here, and Helen was here too. Mm-hmm. Helen?
Yeah.
Caesar's with it.
Oh, yeah?
She was there when she was a child. And my wife was there. And other people. A lot of people used to come. And so they had that. So in 56, I think they count 50. They didn't have to do that. I think they vacated this place in 55. 55, I guess, or 56. It was empty for about 3 or 4 years. And then they decided that they were going to, they don't need it. They have no use for it. They're going to get rid of it. You know, I don't want to be painted. Whatever. And so they decided they're going to get rid of it. And word got around, and this guy worked inside that knew what was happening. This is the one that told him that this guy, three pigs, was going to get it. And he you so much, and they already know how much time you start. And
well, tell it again, because we don't have it on tape.
We didn't have the tape. And so anyway, we thought that this might be the place that was, the distance was right, you know, and everything else had to be, you know, it's up in the mountains, it'd be cooler and so forth. And we can find all the good reasons why we said this would be a good place for us. And, but like I said, they wouldn't show it to us. So this guy, and then we thought, how can we get to that place without knowing that that's us? And we remembered this friend of ours, a movie producer in Hollywood, that years before he'd come to Delano, and everybody was coming to Delano, you know, to support. And he became a good friend, and he was a good guy, and he was interested in the cows and all that. You know. And he says, is there any kind of person I can do for you personally? Yeah. You know, I let Lewis, let me know, see, I can help, I'd like to. And so we were thinking about him, he says, how about Eddie Lewis, you know, somebody said, he said he would wanted to help and all that, maybe he says, you know, maybe it's a good time to see him, he means it, you know. And he set up a meeting, and oh sure, it came running, he came right away, and, says, you know, and he explained to him, he says that, he wrote it, explained to him what was happening, he says, oh yeah, sure, sounds like a good idea. So we've seen the places and all, they won't show it to us. And they know it's us, they won't show it. Well, they're gonna show it to me. And then he called and set an appointment, you know. Yeah, Mr. Lewis, it's a certain date, you know. Yes, but we need somebody of us to see us and look at it. And then he says, Richard would be the one that knows about these things, buildings and equipment and whatever's there. He can tell us, you know, how the buildings are and all that, you know. So but he goes with you. It's a dead ringer. They know him. Mm-hmm. They know it's going to be Caesar's brother. Oh, no, they won't. Who's this? How do you feel like driving a, what do you say, just, how would you like to drive a limousine? I said, I've never driven one, but I'd like to drive. Okay, you're going to be my chauffeur. Okay, one of those little cachetitas. Cachetitas and then some dark glasses, big dark glasses. And he's still come on. Like I was his chauffeur.
Yeah.
And I was that day. And I came. Mr. Lewis is mad. A lot of men wrote, but you know, right to write stuff down to you. He showed us the whole thing, so when he came with a full report about this, what was the buildings and what sizes and how many rooms and so forth, you know. And there was a lot of equipment, the hospital equipment they left there, you know. I make note of everything. And so, yeah, Mr. Thank you, Mr. a lot, Mr. Lewis, and, you know, and so, went back. And yeah, I thought we forgot about it. We're just one of those guys that they showed to a lot of people, I guess, you know. And comes the day that they were going to watch it on. I said, this guy should tell us that he already knows how to get it, how much it is, $90,000. These guys, I think they didn't have a plan. They were so sure that everything was greased, you know. You know, you got them, just gonna get up tonight and they're gonna hit the gavel three times and you got it, you know. The main guy didn't come, the guy that makes the money decisions, I'm sure, because they said was sure it's gonna be 90. At 90 you stop and you're gonna get it, you know. Nobody's gonna go that high, no one can say it. And they sent a blanket, I guess, to the bidding. And this flunky went up to 90. The boss wasn't there to tell him. He said, okay, do I keep him going or whatever? Yeah. They just didn't expect it. And it got to 90, and Mr. Lewis kept it. Mr. Lewis, he says, we're going to get it. Don't worry. Just no matter how far it goes, we'll get it. Don't you guys worry. You got some property.
Yeah.
And so with that in mind, you know, and it kept on going up to 90, 95, 100, 105. And when it got to about 125, I think that was the list. The guy was already sweating and shaking. He didn't know if he could go higher or not, you know, yet. He wasn't, I guess they didn't communicate with him if it goes higher, whatever it was. They were just not prepared to something like that happen, you know. And Lewis kept on bidding, and so the guy said 121, Lewis said 132. And the guy just didn't answer, nobody answered anymore. The gavel sounded three times, Mr. Lewis, you got yourself 102 point something acres up in the area. And that's it. Lewis, it's Mr. Lewis's, you know. Did the deposit or whatever, you know, the escrow and everything, you know. As soon as escrow cleared, he turns it right around and deeds it to the U.S. government. That's when it hit the papers, you know. And then it just, what a story. A coup, and they call it all kinds of things. It's a story. It's a story ran for 2 or 3 days. And, so anyway, we beat them in their same game, but their own game. And we got it. And then after we were supposed to start making payments, you know, and they wouldn't take our money. Because we refused to take our money, they wouldn't take it. So the judge says, oh, you just open an escrow an account, you know, escrow account, just every month put your payment in there. So we did. Mm-hmm. After finally about after 2 years they found out that the money was going to an account. It's very legal, you know.
Yeah.
And they got the money, continued paying to them $138,000 for 200 some odd point acres.
Yeah.
Right now it's worth millions, you know, the property.
Yeah.
Literally millions.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's, we've been lucky that we've been fortunate. That's the way La Paz came about, you know.
Yeah.
And then Caesar, it's called Stony Brook. Everybody knows that we built Stony Brook. Stony Brook Cemetery.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, no, I mean, like, Stony Brook is a nice name, says, but we're going to call it La Paz.
Yeah.
It is a place of peace.
Yeah.
La Paz. It's La Paz.
Now, you then transferred things that were going on at 40 acres to La Paz?
The vein, see, we broke it into the what we call the national headquarters, became La Paz.
Okay.
Before, the national headquarters was in Delano, plus the Delano regional office was combined there.
Yeah.
We were both there, you know. And so the national headquarters moved up to La Paz, and then just left Delano as a regional office.
Okay.
Yeah,
transfer everything up.
Came here. Because
there are all kinds of buildings up here too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you had.
Oh yeah. No, right away we came and started cleaning up stuff. They left all the equipment. You know, it was all the equipment.
Yeah.
I'm sure it was outdated by then.
Yeah.
You know. A lot of stuff we gave away to other places that say, well, they can use this in Mexico.
Yeah.
And pick it up.
Yeah.
Picked up. People came in truckloads of stuff, you know. They took a lot of stuff out of it, a lot of things, you know. Everything that was possible. And, started cleaning up the place, you know, bringing it back to life. First family that moved out here was in 70, at the last part of 1970, was in Murguias. Supposed to stay there. So that was part of whoever bought it, you know. Whoever got La Paz, the caretakers were going to, I don't know, they said caretakers, about 1 or 2 or 3.
Yeah.
We're going to stay for 6 months to teach you every single valve, what closes this.
Yeah.
You know, to teach you the things, you know.
Yes.
Not even a week after that, they were all gone.
They're gone.
They just packed up and left, you know.
Yeah.
And we had to find a lot of stuff for ourselves.
So did a lot of that fall to you then, because you did the development of 40 acres, so now is this your next project then?
I did a lot of it.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Yeah. We did a lot of stuff with these were very tight. Era de Monterrey.
Andale.
Very tight, you know.
Yeah.
And every time we spend money, he was, he was tight, you know.
Yeah.
He said, you know, let's take care of the money again.
Yeah.
And so we did a lot of stuff with recycled stuff. We used stuff. We did. That's why I built my house to recycle. I just couldn't get that out of my head.
Yeah.
And stuff that would give us, like Sin and I would give us truckloads of lumber. You know,
yeah.
Going late. We'd go out there and visit. And says, guys need anything? Says, well, we could use some lumber. We would do that. So, you know, whatever you have. Here comes a semi-fuller with a forklift attached to it, pallets of lumber.
Yeah.
It's sheep rocking, truckload of sheep rocking. So we started fixing things up here. And we got a lot of stuff donated. We bought very little stuff.
Yeah.
You know, small stuff. But now things have changed now. Get a contractor.
Get a contractor and do it, yeah.
You did a lot of stuff.
You mentioned Synanon. Synanon's come up several times with, you know, people that we've interviewed. What, you were getting materials and so on, support from Synanon? What, you know, how did that connection come about? How, you know?
Cesar knew the director, I forget his name now.
Chuck something.
Chuck. Back during the Oxnard.
Okay.
I think Chuck was doing another project over there. He wasn't Synanon anymore. And Synanon, actually, what it was, it's a rehab.
Yeah.
It's a rehab program. It was very successful, you know. Drug addicts and pistols and, you know, alcoholics and all that stuff. They would go there and they had a method of how to bring it back to life, I guess. And they had a pretty good success rate, you know. In fact, Delancey Street is a spin-off of, you know, Delancey Street in San Francisco?
Yeah.
That's a spin-off of Synanon.
Okay.
The guy was in Synanon, he learned his stuff there, and he went and changed a few things and did his own, which has been very successful.
Yeah.
Been successful project. And you know, they were doing well, working with people, you know, bringing people back
They call themselves what, the people organization or the people or the people, there was something
we had a good relationship with them, you know. They would help us in any way they could, you know. So.
Yeah.
And because they were the masters of hustling.
Yeah.
They're just masters. They could hustle, I mean, everything. Yeah. They hustled brand new cars and, you know, motorcycles, anything. They just, everything they built was we call it hustle, and people donated to them.
Yeah.
Because their program was so good, and, you know. Yeah. And they deserved it, because they were doing good work. And so they had a lot of abundance of stuff, you know.
Yeah.
So when we said, like, we need some lumber.
Yeah.
To them, it was giving us a truckload of lumber, was just leaving us a few boards, you know. That's all it amounted to them, you know.
Yeah.
So
much.
And we're doing with the farm workers, so I had a mutual respect there. And we got some stuff from them. Okay. Also, Delancey helped us a lot.
Yeah,
just some stuff.
Okay, we've got the move to La Paz now. What are you doing there?
We made a big jump.
Yeah.
You know, we just started. We didn't talk much about the strike or when we started talking about the acquisition, we skipped all those years from about.
And then we went to the boycott.
Resumed from the beginning of the boycott, or I guess pretty well about the boycott. But we didn't talk about other things, important things back in 65 to 70, you know, like the fasts and the march, Sacramento, we didn't talk about that, all those major events back then, because we jumped over to the acquisition stuff.
So. Yeah.
That's right.
Probably we're at 68, we've been talking about the boycott, we probably need to talk about the march now, huh?
The march. Okay, I think the fast was first.
The march first.
Yeah, okay. Stop.
Chuck Dietrich.
Chuck Dietrich, exactly.
Yeah.
You got it.
As soon as you walked away,
Chuck
I said, Dietrich. It's Chuck Dietrich.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. That's him.
Yep.
Sinanan.
Sinanan. Okay, but well, we wanted to go back and talk about the fast.
March 1st.
The March 1st.
The March.
Okay.
March, and then the Shenley contract came during the March, right?
That's right. Okay. That's right. That's right. We were doing that boycott. That was the Shenley boycott. Mm-hmm. And we did the DiGiorgio what was the brand name? Well, it was DiGiorgio anyway. Boycott also, S&W. S&W boycott, and then the Shenley boycott. The Shenley was easy because it was pisto, you know. And so it was... it was a very, very, very good names, you know, that we could, I mean, target, and there was no getting away, you know. And it was just a label boycott. That was sort of easy, you know. Anyway, we Shenley found out right fast that we were digging into their pockets, and they said, okay, let's this is nothing compared to everything else that we have, you know. This is like, this is nickel and dime stuff here. We're talking about losing millions of dollars in this nickel and dime stuff. I recognize you guys. So we got a contract. That happened on the march. Okay, the march.
Before we go on now, when you were boycotting Shenley, you were also, you had boycotters out of liquor stores and stuff as well, didn't you?
Yeah.
Seems like, yeah.
See?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And wasn't the Bartenders Union supporting, wasn't there something with Gilbert Padilla and the bartenders?
I don't remember that.
Blackie
Levitz?
Levitz was the head of the Blackie Bartenders Levitz? Union?
I don't remember. Not enough to okay. Talk about it, you know. Okay. There might have been something. I don't know.
And why did Shenley? Why were they so willing to sign?
Because, like I said, you know, our operation, it would cost them a nickel, you know.
Uh-huh.
And we were hurting them $100 up here, you know.
Because they had only a small vineyard.
Yeah,
it was
yeah.
Only a small
yeah,
part of
yeah.
Their,
there was nothing to it. It was a big operation, yeah, you know. Yeah, yeah. And we were doing a lot of damage to his name, you know.
Yeah.
And here they try to save a nickel over here, you know.
And of course, all the other Shenley operations were already unionized, weren't they?
Yes, I mean, most of them, yeah. So it was didn't make sense
the
to fight us and all that. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. It was. There was
it's
not
a different
too much.
Kind of businessman than the growers, right?
Exactly. And so anyway, the reason for the march to Sacramento is because we're talking to the old Brown, the Governor Brown.
Edmund.
Yeah. And we wanted him to do something for us. We wanted some help. You know, we wanted him to intervene and all that stuff, and he wouldn't do it, you know. And so he said, well, let's do a march and go right to his doorsteps and tell him over there right in front of him. And he wasn't even there when we got there. You know, so. But it all worked out because...
Around
Easter time? I think we arrived on Easter. And we timed it so we would arrive on Easter, you know. And also that was to get... everything we did, we were getting national publicity that you couldn't... Sometimes you can't buy that, you know, no matter how much money you have, you know. And here we're getting it just because we're getting the numbers out, you know. I mean, Cesar was a gobble for that, you know. He just...